is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. Here with Paul Steinhauser, which will be our final original edition of On Background in 2019. The campaign trail has been a bit quiet this week, so it is a good time to reflect on what has been a very intriguing First Nation presidential primary to date. So we're going to kind of go through what's been happening over the last year and discuss that here on the program. Look ahead to voting, which will obviously occur on February the 11th here in the Granite State. Welcome in right now, Paul Steinhauser from Fox News and the Concord Monitor. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing well. I can't believe it's been, this year is just about over. Chris, it's, when we started this year, Elizabeth Warren had just jumped in on New Year's Eve. We've seen a lot of ups and downs and a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah, so I think, in exploring some of the big themes of this campaign, I think that the first thing that comes to mind is the size of the field. This has been a massive presidential field, one that has shrunk as expected. Both because of the natural flow of campaigns, and there's only so much money to go around, but also due to the DNC process. I think that has shrunk the field as well. So we started with a historic number of candidates and a number of individuals who thought that this could happen for them, and for some candidates it has, like a Tulsi Gabbard or for an Andrew Yang to some extent. Obviously, they're not amongst the front runners. But, this campaign has seen three individuals who are the biggest names in the field, atop the field, and Pete Buttigieg, who was one of the longest of long shots, joining them at this point in time.
25. That's where we kind of topped out with the number of candidates over the summer. 27 people have announced at one time or another in this campaign, 27 Democrats, but 12 have dropped out. So we're roughly down to about 15 right now. But yeah, record setting. We broke the record back in the 2016 cycle when about, some people say 17, some people say 18 Republicans were running for the White House. That record was easily shattered this time around. And here's why. There was never one Democrat, not even the former Vice President Joe Biden, that scared everybody else off. Now, 4 years ago, it was a foregone conclusion that Hillary Clinton was going to be running for president. We all knew that. We knew that after 2012, right? We knew that after she stepped down from the State Department in early 2013. We knew that in the midterms in 14. During her book tour, when she went across the country, it was kind of a rehearsal for the campaign. That scared almost everybody out of the race except for two people, Martin O'Malley, the former Maryland governor, and Bernie Sanders. So it was very different this time around. A very large field, nobody really, scaring anybody else off, and history made again.
Indeed. So what were the dynamics, do you think, that created the size of the field? You mentioned that last time around, Hillary Clinton was able to clear that field. This time around, Joe Biden obviously was not able to clear that field. And I think a lot of it had to do basically with Donald Trump for a number of different reasons. One of the reasons was that Donald Trump proved that you don't have to be one of the front runners in order to have success to start a contest, that you can come into things as a political novice. And the fact is that a lot of people are looking for that. They're looking for people as far outside as Washington as possible. So somebody like Marianne Williamson was able to have a couple moments in the sun during the course of this campaign, make the debate stage a couple of times. Andrew Yang, of course, has become one of the, not necessarily the top tier candidates, but just outside of that. Tom Steyer has come into this race and spent a lot of money. He's on the debate stage once again. And Mike Bloomberg is in this race. So I think that Trump changed the type of individual that runs for president and has success in running for president. And a lot of folks saw that. I also think that there was that why not me attitude that existed amongst members of Congress, many of which are now littering the, the roadways of the First Nation presidential primary. But, I think that dynamic exists where everybody kind of looked and said, we can do this. We have a shot.
Yeah, I think Barack Obama broke some of the rules back in the 2008 cycle because he had only been in the U.S. Senate for 2 years when he launched his presidential campaign. And a lot of people said, well, you got to wait your time. That's not how we do it, right? You build up, you go from the House to the Senate, or you go from the governorship. Obama didn't do that. He shattered some of the rules. As you mentioned, all the remaining rules were shattered by Donald Trump in 2016. And that allowed anybody now to think that they can run for president and become a leading contender. And guess what? As you said, yeah. I mean, one of our top-tier contenders right now is Pete Buttigieg. I remember back in January when you and I first interviewed him on via phone before he even got here to New Hampshire. I mean, we couldn't pronounce his name, never heard of the guy. But look, he became a top-tier contender, not because he's been in Washington or in government for a long time, not at all. And that's the way it is nowadays. Your father's and my father's and mother's rules are long gone.
Indeed, and you saw that in the course of this campaign as well, where there were good candidates, individuals who would probably have had some success in past campaigns who did not have any success this time around. Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, was an individual that stood out. Also, you know, John Hickenlooper, governor of Colorado, both individuals who had good records as governors of those states, but were unable to get anything going. Kirsten Gillibrand, another individual that came into this race with a lot of prestige and interest.
The Me Too senator.
Yeah, Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. It's been pretty interesting because the reasons that those individuals, we'll take those individuals that are on the debate stage tonight, there is a lot of different reasons that those folks are there. And that to me is one of the intriguing dynamics too, is that we have seen traditional politicians with not great name ID, senators, governors, members of Congress, they have all fallen by the wayside. But I think you've had an individual like Pete Buttigieg, who has a unique story and is able to resonate and connect with voters. He has had success. While many of the other individuals have not.
Let me mention three others who maybe in years past would have been, fantastic because of their resumes. Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, a lot of accomplishments for a progressive lawmaker in a very red state. Just couldn't resonate. He had the looks. He has the voice. He's got everything. Maybe he'll be a VP nominee. We'll see. What about Tim Ryan? The guy spent almost 20 years in Congress in Ohio. Blue-collar guy fighting for unions. This is the kind of guy that you'd think you'd want, especially if you want to win back those blue-collar states that Donald Trump won, turned from blue to red to capture the White House. Another one, here's a war hero, Representative Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Four tours of duty in Iraq. This guy's seen combat like nobody. I mean, I'm sorry, Tulsi Gabbard, and I'm sorry, Pete Buttigieg, but your military records can't come close to Moulton. But again, couldn't resonate. Couldn't get a spark of fine lightning in a bottle and is long gone now.
Yeah, he didn't even make the debate stage. But an individual that there's been a number of candidates too that you could see how they would do well here in New Hampshire, and it just hasn't happened for them. Why do you think that is? Is it the oxygen has been taken up by those top tier candidates and it's become more nationalized? You look at Seth Moulton, you're like, he could probably find a niche here. You mentioned his record, a commander-in-chief type of candidate. To me, the candidates who try to find a niche within this race based upon their bio or based upon a specific policy agenda or idea, that all made sense as to try to how to go about getting some notoriety and recognition, but didn't happen.
Nope, didn't happen. And you're right. Part of this is the nationalization of the campaign. Listen, the candidates are still coming to Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada as well, the other early voting states. That hasn't changed. And they're spending plenty of time here. But New Hampshire and the other early voting states have become more of a playground for the national campaign. Then that wasn't the case in yesteryear. So we're still important, but things have definitely changed. Retail politicking, the old-fashioned New Hampshire way, candidates are still doing it, and the ones who do it very well will have success. But at the same time, things have changed dramatically. Social media has changed the way a candidate's campaign, the way voters get their information.
That's a really big point. And I talked about this the other night on New England Cable News, where I've seen just a shift in how campaigns campaign in New Hampshire. A little bit redundant there. But it's, in the past, you would see two or three, and I sound like the old school get off my lawn dude here. But you'd see, two or three day trips packed with events. where the focus would be on voter contact. How many voters can the individual meet on a day-in, day-out basis? Let's get them from event to event, four or five events, town hall meetings, shake hands.
Get those addresses and phone numbers and emails.
Yeah, get those and get that data into the system. Where this campaign, it's been more like, okay, one day, two, three events. One of them is going to be a retail stop where we get some good visuals, and that's going to be it. The amount of time spent in New Hampshire, visits, we may find at the end of the campaign that visits are similar to what we've seen in past in terms of how many times the candidate is there. But the length of time, the amount of events, that has all changed. And I think that a lot of it, as you mentioned, has to do with the nationalization of the process where the time spent on fundraising is important. And I also think that, as you referenced with social media, it is a situation where campaigns can feel like they were in more places than they actually were in a state, because for each selfie that is taken, you know, that's 400 individuals that are looking at that picture with that person. And it you can permeate throughout a state in a time period that is shorter in a way that is perhaps more significant than you could in the past.
Yeah, no, you make a great point. You know, there have been some barnstorming trips, I think, of Beto O'Rourke's first two visits, two swings through the state, which were just incredible for the number of stops, the breakneck pace. Amy Klobuchar, back in October after a debate success, had a two-day swing that was jam-packed. But we're not seeing as many of those.
Buttigieg's bus tour.
Yep, another good one, good one. But yeah, overall, we're not seeing maybe the kind of events or schedules we've seen in years past. Maybe blame Donald Trump again. He spent a lot of time here in New Hampshire in 2016, but it was mostly in for a big event or two and out that same night. And you know what? It worked.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump only spent one night in New Hampshire throughout the course of the entire campaign, which is pretty remarkable. And he liked to fly in, liked to fly out. And Bernie Sanders ran a pretty similar campaign. He spent more time here, but again, it was town halls, giving a speech, and leaving. And his day was generally more packed than Trump's, but not a lot of retail from Bernie Sanders. We started to see a little bit more of that during the course of this campaign. And that's been a story, too, in that, you know, the old boss, the new boss may be the same as the old boss in this primary, with Bernie Sanders winning. But he's gone about it a very different way in this particular campaign, where he's been a kinder, gentler Bernie. He's made jokes. He's laughed at himself. He's danced. He's done a whole bunch of different things that he didn't do in the last campaign. Taking selfies. He's been engaged with voters in a way that he wasn't in the past.
Yeah, voters want something new, and the same old tricks from 2016 aren't always going to play. You know, Bernie Sanders is a very different situation this time. Obviously, he's got competition other than just Hillary Clinton, and he's got a lot of candidates in this race that are preaching the same proposals that he made turn from extreme to mainstream in the 2016 campaign. So, yes, you need to do a new and improved Bernie Sanders, and we saw that because he was kind of running the same old campaign the first couple months. There was a campaign shakeup here in New Hampshire over the summer with the Sanders campaign, and now we've seen a more lively Sanders, and guess what? He's back right near the top, part of that top-tier contenders, right at the top just about in some of the polling, and it's paid off.
Another big topic of conversation, we're going to get into our interviews here in just a little bit, Bill Weld, as Weld is in the race still and running against Donald Trump.
Still.
It's important to note, we want to make sure that you know what's going on, and the fact that he's on the show indicates that Bill Weld is still in the race for president. And Kazir Khan, who is one of the more intriguing political figures that we've seen, as he rose to prominence in the 2016 Democratic National Convention, and is one of those individuals who's been kind of like thrust into certain moments in history that didn't necessarily expect that was going to take place. And I find those individuals to be absolutely fascinating. Not the person necessarily works to be an historic figure, but the person who has a moment in time that kind of encapsulates a particular feeling in that instance. Rosa Parks, didn't expect to be a national historic figure on that day, and I don't think Kazir Khan did either. So we'll hear from him in just a little bit. But one of the other major topics of discussion, and it always is, okay, this primary is great. What about the next one? And, what is the future of the New Hampshire primary? And there's always some doubt that exists about what you know the future is going to be in general, let alone with the New Hampshire primary. But the New Hampshire primary is so organic in many different ways, and you know there is always a chance that a change comes about, and that has been a big topic of conversation in this particular campaign, even with candidates weighing in on the lack of diversity in New Hampshire and in Iowa as well. So what are your feelings on that? Do you feel that this is, you know, you mentioned some of the changes we've seen in terms of candidate activity, and that you know, this, and I think that this was really the case in the last campaign too, where New Hampshire has become more of a backdrop in terms of the campaigning that takes place. The voting is still significant and has a meaning. But do you feel that with that dissipation of candidate activity and the complaints that are taking place, that there is some jeopardy for the primary, perhaps more enhanced than in previous cycles?
Ray Buckley, who's the longtime chairman of the Democratic Party here in New Hampshire, he's got a fight on his hands. That fight's going to start early in 2021 when the Democratic National Committee reconvenes after the election. Because, yeah, there has been more criticism, I think, in this cycle than maybe in the last cycle or two before, previous on the Democratic side when it comes to that lack of diversity in Iowa and here in New Hampshire. And we've seen candidates. Take Julian Castro, for instance, you know, the only Latino candidate in the race, former Secretary of Housing for President Obama and San Antonio mayor. He came up here a lot back in 2017 and 2018. He loved New Hampshire then, but he didn't make the debate stage after the first initial debates, and he has been railing against New Hampshire ever since. The fact that neither of the two major black candidates in the race, Kamala Harris, who's now out of the race, and Cory Booker, couldn't make this, weren't going to be on the debate stage this week, and Deval Patrick as well, who jumped in, another African-American candidate, that also kind of amplified these calls for a change in the primary process. And you've got Mike Bloomberg's campaign chairman, Kevin Cheeky, his campaign manager, railing against New Hampshire and Iowa, not for demographic components, but basically because they're not crucial general election battleground states. And he also called for a reordering of the calendar. So there will be fights ahead, no doubt about that. New Hampshire has successfully, on both sides of the aisle, both Democratic and Republican, have fought back and have kept their status. Nothing's guaranteed, though, Chris.
Yeah, there's no question that New Hampshire will vote first. The question is how that dynamic works and whether or not is a sanctioned primary or is basically, you know, just a photo op type of primary where no delegates are awarded. And it's a difficult dance. So it's one that New Hampshire and Bill Gardner has won in the past with just strength and just saying, yeah, this is the way it's going to be. It's a state law. It's going to happen. And there has been, you know, some nuance as well involved with that. But I'm not sure that that works this time around. There may have to be some sort of concessions that take place. And that may be challenging because of what the state law is. And, you know, I've referenced one possible concession, and that is that you could say that it is a 3-day period between New Hampshire and Nevada, and then a 3-day period between Nevada and South Carolina. Same with Iowa and New Hampshire. So you move everything and you create a more condensed environment so that the results in New Hampshire don't necessarily doom candidates. Same thing in Iowa, where the winnowing doesn't take place and that all four of the early states are viewed basically as being one, because of the lack of a time period that exists in between those primaries. Now, of course, that's blasphemy for people who fought for New Hampshire and the First Nation tradition for many years. But I feel that with the news cycle, things have changed dramatically, and 7 days is not the same as it once was. And you know, the pitchforks might be a little hotter than they have been in the past.
Oh, they're going to be a lot hotter. And there's going to be a lot of sore losers coming out of this primary process that are going to vent their frustration and anger forward and take it out on Iowa and New Hampshire in 2021 when this will all be decided for 2024. Listen, there was a concession about 2 decades ago, and that is Nevada. Right, they added Nevada because it has what Iowa and New Hampshire don't have. It's got a major urban area in Las Vegas. It's got a high concentration of Latino voters and a decent concentration of African-American voters and other minorities that neither Iowa or New Hampshire has. And when you talk about people defending Iowa and New Hampshire, you always hear them say, well, when you take all four of the early voting states, including South Carolina, where at least on the Democratic side, you got a majority of African-American voters making up the electorate there. They say if you take all four in totality, it's a real clear representation of the U.S. That argument, true, but may not be enough anymore. That's a fight that we're going to be talking about a year and a half from now.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that this is going to be a very difficult battle for Ray Buckley and others, in particular because Cory Booker looks like he may be on the brink of not moving forward in this campaign. And that would mean Julian Castro is staying in for now, but for all intents and purposes is out. Kamala Harris is out. All the black and brown candidates outside of Deval Patrick, who entered late, would be out of the race, and Andrew Yang would be the lone minority candidate still on the stage.
Now, can you blame, is it New Hampshire's fault or Iowa's fault?
No,
it isn't. No, right.
The circumstances have created this.
Right.
And all those individuals have not polled well nationally or polled well in states that have, greater amounts of minority voters. They will argue that minority voters are disproportionately polled as compared to Caucasian voters. Some of the campaigns would. But, the facts are, the facts where the polling numbers have not been there for those individuals. And the fact that, Castro and perhaps others are saying that they haven't gotten a fair shake, that's going to resonate.
Yeah, no, it will. And again, that's a story we'll be covering after the 2020 election, a little over a year from now. One thing that may make a difference is if a Democrat wins the White House and beats Trump, that person obviously will have great say and sway over what the DNC does. And if that person, let's say it's Joe Biden, hypothetically, and if he comes out and says New Hampshire and Iowa need to remain where they are, that's what's going to happen. You saw that with Trump on the Republican side coming out early in his tenure in the White House and saying, he loves New Hampshire. Its place is safe for now.
Right. And, you look at the potential Democratic winners, and I would say Buttigieg is going to support the First Nation primary. Biden's going to support it. Sanders, I don't think he's been on the record in regards to it, but I would expect that he would. Elizabeth Warren, I don't know. I don't know. I think that she spent obviously a lot of time here, but it'd be interesting to hear her take on whether she would full-throated at least support the New Hampshire primary if president. That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. When we return, conversation with Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, and whether or not he is starting to feel a little pressure to move on to something different than running for president. We'll talk about that as Paul and I return after this On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan here inside the WKXL studio, beneath the earth here on Reddington Road, as Paul Hodes would say. So what were your takeaways from your conversation with Bill Weld that we're going to hear from here in a second?
He's not dropping out of the race anytime soon. That's pretty clear. He's in it, through the primary, at least through the New Hampshire primary on February 11th. He's been up here every week. Basically, since February when he first flirted with this, and definitely since April when he declared his long shot primary challenge against President Trump on the Republican side. And he remains optimistic, even though the polling sure doesn't give him any room or any ammunition to remain optimistic. He does. Take a listen. Welcome back to New Hampshire, first of all.
Great to be here. It feels like I never left.
You have, you've been here almost every week, dating back to April when you jumped in.
Yeah, no, I think we have been here every week. From now on, it's going to be a majority of days. Certainly, now we've been here recently knocking on doors in Newcastle on Saturday, and yesterday at Amherst and Bedford, and mixing a talk last night to the Mental Illness Coalition, and we're on our way in an hour or so to Concord Rotary for a luncheon remarks. So good mix of, political retail and just talking to folks.
As we get closer to the primary, and we're less than 2 months away now, do you see yourself going up with either radio or TV spots to get the word out as well, the message out?
TV.
Coming in the new year?
No, I think December, but you know, I'm not allowed to coordinate that with the Super PAC and the other vessel, upstairs vessel. I got it.
So it'll come from the PAC, not from your campaign?
It'll come from Stuart Stevens, not from me.
Gotcha. I haven't talked to you since before impeachment made it to the House, and I'm wondering whether you look at the polling, and it looks like Republicans nationwide, if you believe the polls, are sticking with the president. Obviously, congressional Republicans are sticking. Does that help or hurt you as you now try to, you know, challenge him?
Well, that would... It hurts, I suppose, but it doesn't change my message, which is that they better watch out how they, you know, stick up for Trump if 50% of the country thinks he should be removed, you know, because they can't retain their seats, the Republicans who are up next year, by winning the primary. They got to win the general election.
Anything, you told me about a couple months ago that impeachment was going to be quite a boon for your campaign. Do you still feel that way?
That's not the feeling that's out there right now, you know, the last couple of days. I'm somewhat surprised at the tenacity with which Mr. Trump is clinging to the loyalty of Republicans. It ain't unanimous, as we've seen from the people starting the super PAC to go against Mr. Republican super PAC to go against Mr. Trump and the sitting members of Congress who are supporting him. So it's going to be a bloody year for sure.
You know, let me ask about that super PAC, which was just forming, you know, this morning as we sit down. Does that kind of amplify your message?
Oh, that's the same message. It's that, you know, the president has misbehaved and deserved to be removed, and the only way that the country, which is now exhausted and on its back, you know, Mr. Trump doesn't have 100% name recognition. He has 1,000%, and that's too much. The only way that the country is going to be able to heave a sigh of relief and get on with its business is if he is removed, and I think that might sink in.
For you personally, what do you need, what kind of finish do you need in the New Hampshire primary to A, continue on, or to B, send a message to the president? What are we looking at?
Well, I've got to have enough success in New Hampshire to give me a sufficient following win to get to Super Tuesday, when I've got Massachusetts, Vermont, California, Colorado, a whole bunch of appealing states. And I think, you know, the aim is a win or place, which would be vastly beyond expectations. But, you know, I sense things moving in New Hampshire. I was the only candidate to march in either the Concord Holiday Parade or the Manchester Christmas Parade, and people were running into the street saying, can't you get rid of him, can't you get rid of him? They don't even want to pronounce the president's name. They're so tired. And everyone's exhausted. That's the overwhelming sentiment that I sense in the country as I travel around, not just New Hampshire. It's exhaustion and a form of anxiety. It's too bad, really.
Most recent poll up here was last week from WBUR. Mass Inc. did it. And on the Republican side, they had the president around 75%. You were at 9%. That's not enough, I'm assuming, come primary day.
Most of the polls I've seen have me in the teens trending towards 20.
What do you need to finish that?
Well, I wouldn't put a numerical figure on it, but I'd say to briskly outpace expectations. You know, Pat Buchanan got 37%. And in retrospect, given the no new taxes issue, maybe that's not so surprising, but it was more than people thought, and so Pat went on to perform similarly in later primaries.
You think you can repeat that success here?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, I think if things break my way, I think I can do better than that.
You've told me and other reporters plenty of times that you're banking on independents. They make up 40% of the electorate here. You banking on them coming into the voting stations and picking up a Republican primary card. Is that still realistic with all the action on the Democratic side?
Well, I certainly have traction when I talk to independents in New Hampshire about that. So we'll see. But people seem receptive to that notion that they can cast a vote against Mr. Trump early and be sure that it comes out of his pocket. Not everyone's a Trump fan.
Governor, I appreciate your time as always.
Thank you.
That is Bill Weld with Paul Steinhauser. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Up next, individual who rose to great national prominence as a result of a singular moment at the DNC convention in 2016. Kazir Khan is next on Background, presented by the Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. I sat down with Kazir Khan, an individual who rose to great prominence after a moment that was one that will forever be remembered in politics at the 2016 convention, in which he held up a pocket constitution and asked President Trump if, in fact, he had ever read the Constitution.
So I wanted to start with, you are, have become an historic figure based upon, you know, circumstances and time. And various people through history never envisioned themselves being in that particular situation. Rosa Parks, a person that, that comes to mind. Did you have any idea when you stood with the Constitution at the convention that this would follow, and what led you to rise in that moment?
No, we had no idea. We were planning to go home and disappear from the limelight. We are a humble, modest family. We wanted to get back to our peace and quiet. And but as the time went by after the convention, we began to feel the need, the letters of affection that came to us, the people that we met, the calls, telephone calls, emails, letters, they all said, thank you for reminding us of our Constitution. Thank you for reminding us of the goodness of America. And we begin to realize that there is a tremendous, tremendous need to bring hope to people that were in despair, that remain in despair, because they believe in the goodness of America and they don't see that in the incumbent. So we have continued to speak. But I, even today, given the choice, I speak and I travel and I have left family behind, and I have continued to do this speaking is to hearten the community out of concern for our democracy, for our rule of law, for our checks and balances, for our Bill of Rights. It is that work that gives me strength to continue to move forward and speak.
You're incredibly eloquent and have a grace by which you speak, but have also been through, obviously, extremely difficult circumstances. And part of your discussion here was calling on other individuals to rise and to make their voices heard, that we are the candle holders here in New Hampshire. So what about your particular experience, though, allowed for you to be able to do this, in your view, where others are, you know, reticent to step forward and speak, whether they're concerned about, you know, what may happen to them personally, how individuals may view them? People don't want to speak because of the type of vitriol that exists in politics that you've experienced.
Well, it is unfortunate, because America remains beacon of hope for the world, center of freedom, liberty, and equal dignity. It is darkest time in our history, and those of us that are disheartened, that are worried but do not speak, of course, it is their choice. But the call of the time is that we all must, whatever we can, some are at a platform where they can speak, some are at a platform where they can participate in primary, participate in campaigns and move us forward, but we must do. Not doing anything is not the choice anymore. We must do our part. Our Constitution, our democracy, our liberty, our freedom is at stake. Time has shown us, the last 3 years have been proof, that authoritarianism, isolationism will not work. It's not in the character of this blessed nation. This blessed nation has been, is part of history to uplift the mankind, to show the better way. And as a citizen of this, as an honored citizen of this nation. I took the oath that I will defend the Constitution of the United States. And every American has that obligation to defend when you see a violation of the Constitution of this blessed nation. Stand up, speak. If you cannot stand up and speak, do your best so you can look back and you will say, yes, whatever was within my means, I did that in support of my country and my Constitution.
You speak a lot about the idea of America, basically, and the idea of America and how it's viewed through individuals who don't live here, and particularly amongst immigrants as well. And I'm curious, you know, are you concerned that the idea of America cannot survive another 4 years of Donald Trump, or will it just leave a blemish on our country? Do you think, basically, that America and the Constitution that you speak about can survive Trumpism?
Yes, it will survive. It has survived. We have gone through civil war when everybody thought that this union will fall apart. We have survived that. We have survived the darkest moment of 50s and 60s, the McCarthy era. We will survive this. We will come out of it better because there are better leaders among us. We just need to make sure that we join those leaders, and that is why I am supporting leader by example, Joe Biden, by example of service to this nation, 40 plus years of service to this nation, honorable service to this nation. He's a military parent, and he understands what it takes to serve. He has served himself, his family has served. So it is such moment that has defined, if you read the history, you will come up with the same conclusion as I have, is that the nations that have been created, there is a divine hand in American history, and the call of the time is that we stand for our democracy, for our rule of law, and we will survive.
Final thing is, how much do you think that your story also kind of defines the greatness of America? And obviously, as I referenced before, you've suffered great sacrifice for that to take place, but this country obviously allows for an individual such as yourself to gain a national prominence in which you can discuss these issues and do so in a way that advances it, similar to we've seen other individuals throughout the course of our history. So what about circumstance and time allows for that to take place, and how do you see, you know, your role moving forward?
Well, I'm a humble, private, modest, half-educated individual.
Maybe three-quarters.
I don't see that much. I only speak because I have seen it in my past. I have seen how authoritarians begin to take hold in democracies. And when I see our incumbent in the White House doing exactly same things that other dictators, authoritarians have done, have violated the Constitution, I feel compelled because I have been honored to be the citizen of the United States. And the life of Captain Humayun Khan is an example. We only brought a two-year-old child to this country. He was made in here. He was made by the values and the goodness of America, by the goodness of and the training of the military that prepared him, that he stood firmly in front of the danger, full well knowing that was the threat to his existence, but he remained firm. It is such moments that give us courage, that give us strength, that this is our time. We continue to speak for the goodness of America, for the dignity that it bestows upon not only its citizens, but by being the guiding light for the rest of the mankind.
We have to wrap, but you mentioned you wanted to talk about the media as well prior to the conversation.
Yes, I wish to express, my voice rises when I say, to the fourth pillar of our democracy, and that is our free press. Free press has an important role in the strength of the democracy. And Free Press will look back and will say, yes, when in the darkest moment, we remain the bright light for our democracy. So thank you to our Free Press. Thank you to our media for continuing to play that role, because without Free Press, we will have nothing but Hong Kong all over in the United States.
You mentioned authoritarianism, too, and one of the aspects of trying to gain control and rule is by attacking entities and individuals that look to spread truth, and that's been evident.
I think there are. I have witnessed throughout the nation, throughout the country, folks like yourself that are member of the Free Press that are holding our democracy together, and I have nothing but admiration and praise for our media, for our Free Press. Continue. The nation depends on your patriotic duty that you're performing. So continue with that, and you will look back once this darkest moment in history is behind us, that yes, it was the media, it was the Free Press that remained, that kept the light holding in the darkest moment.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That is Kazir Khan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan with Paul Steinhauser as we wrap up what is our final original show of 2019. We talked a lot about where we've come in regards to the primary and also where the primary may be headed in the future. But here in this final segment, you know, where things are headed in regards to this particular primary, which candidates still have a shot, which candidates are looking good here in New Hampshire. We're going to talk about that here in this final segment of the program On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. So I think that, looking specifically at the New Hampshire primary, I've said this before, Bernie Sanders to me is the favorite until he is knocked off. I feel like, the new boss is going to be the same as the old boss here in New Hampshire, but there's going to be challenges, and he is not going to win by a significant margin, in my view. I think that his current situation, and he is leading and atop the polls in the Mercury Politics average, I think that he's going to see some voters return home. I think some undecided voters are going to come in his direction. And I think that's going to buoy him and get him to that magical 25% margin, in my view. The other candidate to watch right now is Buttigieg, where I feel that he has a strong amount of the grassroots support here in New Hampshire. There seems to be an energy and excitement to him. His crowds are big. He seems to resonate well because of a lot of his messaging, and a progressive who still has, though, that willingness and desire to work across the aisle, bring aboard individuals to his campaign that don't necessarily agree with him. It's a good pitch to independent voters, in other words, here in New Hampshire, and I think that's going to be helpful to him.
Yeah, a couple other candidates to look at. Let's start with Cory Booker. Contrary to what Politico reported, because there really wasn't a lot of there in their story, Booker has not, started to break down or take apart his campaign here in New Hampshire. He has about 25 staffers on the ground, which is what he had over the summer. So they're not kind of reducing the boots on the ground here in New Hampshire. They did close one campaign office, but he's got, his staff is nothing comparable to the top four contenders, but he's going to be back here right after the new year, the first day or two. He connects well with voters. Keep your eyes on him. He's going to be spending a lot of time in Iowa and South Carolina, but also a good amount of time here. Michael Bennett.
So you think he's in it to win it? Or do you think that if he's not able to get on the debate stage in January, that it's a problem for him?
We don't know the criteria yet for that. That's Iowa true. Debate on the 14th of January. There's been a lot of pressure to either bring the standards back, the criteria, the thresholds back to what they were earlier in the cycle. I think, regardless of Booker, I think the Democrats are going to have a huge issue if you still don't have a Booker or a Castro or somebody of color, of diversity, on that debate stage in January. This December debate, I don't think anybody's going to be watching this one. So maybe they get a pass. I don't think Booker's I may be wrong. I don't think he's going to fold up now. I think he's going to probably be in at least through the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. And then if he doesn't do well in either of those, yes, he's out.
Yeah, to me, you know, the discussion of whether he's going to drop out in January is kind of ridiculous because you're almost there. Like, you're why not make it to
at least
to
Iowa.
Voting?
Yeah. If you don't do well in Iowa, then you drop out, right? If you have a bad finish and you just forget it.
Right.
But yeah, that political article I think was a little overblown because there have not been any staff reductions here. They haven't added to staff, but they haven't taken away. Michael Bennett, this guy is basically 100% New Hampshire now. He's the longest of long shots as well, but he's got a good resume. He seems to connect pretty well with voters. I was on the campaign trail with him about a week ago. I don't expect much, but keep your eyes on him. You know, maybe. Keep your eyes on Tulsi Gabbard. She polls well here. She's going to be spending a lot of time here over the next month leading up to the primary. So we'll see.
Yeah, I feel like there's a good amount of support for her. And she's able to draw from a number of different cross sections, which creates that, you know, 6-7%. How much upwards mobility she has, I don't really think
Not so much.
So I think she's kind of topped out at where she's going to be in polling and may, you know, when voting comes around, end up a little bit less than there as, as voters decide to go with candidates that have a better chance to win.
The other one I forgot to mention, I think you'll agree with me with this, is Amy Klobuchar. She'll be in Iowa a lot between now and February 3rd. She'll also spend some time here. I mean, rumor has it she'll be back right before the end of the new year, and I'm sure that'll be official in a day or two, if it isn't already. She is somebody, and we'll see how she does in the debates, but also, I think, more importantly, her time on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah, she needs a second act after what she hopes is a strong finish in Iowa. Now, if she doesn't do well in Iowa, she may not make it to voting here in New Hampshire. But I think that her campaign feels good right now about a potential top three finish in Iowa. But a top three finish in Iowa, if you're going to move forward, is going to have to be followed by a strong finish here in New Hampshire. And that's going to be tough because that top four is pretty solidified here. In Iowa, doesn't seem to be as much with Warren falling a little bit there, and Sanders' number not as good in Iowa either. Paul, as always, great to see you, and we will talk to you again very shortly.
Enjoy the holidays, my friend.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.